you could take an adult education course.
Oh, and how is education supposed to make me feel smarter?
And that's going to be one of the questions we tackle today here on Your Money. Gene Purcell here filling in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is with us today, managing member at McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Gene.
And as the opening clip implied, we're going to be talking about education. But before we do that, it wouldn't be a normal day in Wisconsin if I didn't ask how the weather was. Is it hot enough for you?
As I told Joy a few weeks ago, yeah. It's not the heat that gets to me. It's the stupidity. That's what I'm really tired of. I've had enough of it.
Fair enough. Well, you know, we're out to cure some of that today with education, and we're going to be talking about higher education today on Your Money. And we've got a kind of a timely way to start. And Kevin, you say that one of the few items of agreement in the debt ceiling debate of the past few days could be bad news for current and for future graduate students.
It was amazing to me, with all this rancor and contention going on between all the parties, one thing that they agreed on in both the Boehner and the Reid plans, and it was brought up even by President Obama a few months ago, is that they want to cancel subsidized graduate student loans, meaning loans that generally have lower interest rates and better terms. Now, unsubsidized and private student loans will still be available for grad students, but they're, of course, going to have higher interest rates and be more difficult to not only get, but repay. And since over half of grad students typically borrow money to go to school, and the average balance can be anywhere from $30,000 up to $120,000 for, you know, people going to med school, with the loans harder to get, there's going to be some interesting upshots for this, because there is going to be probably less demand for grad school programs, and people are going to be more likely to get in as long as they can actually pay cash. It will hurt those applicants who actually need to borrow money to afford to pay for grad school.
And that's assuming we can get in the first place. I mean, how hard is it right now to get into a post-graduate program right now?
It's interesting because, of course, the worse the economy gets, a bunch of people say, you know what, there are either no jobs out there, or I lost my job, or there are no jobs that I like. I might as well go to grad school. So there's a rise in applications. Even from 2008 to 2009, there was an 8.3% rise in graduate school applications, and that was just the beginning of the recession. There's been a commensurate rise in prices because, with all that demand, of course, schools have been able to raise the overall cost of going to grad school. Now, interestingly, those people who get degrees, who actually get through graduate programs, come out with a degree, all of them help devalue their degree in the aggregate because there are more people who have one. But then it, of course, makes it more crucial that one has that graduate or master's degree or what have you, because more people have one. And so if you don't have one, you tend to stand out more in the job field.
So what questions could help a would-be student decide whether all of this is worth it?
They are hard questions to ask because it's not just financial. It's about your life, it's about your career, and it's about your identity. Generally, the first and most important question is, can you or someone else pay cash for the cost of doing it? Are you doing this as an actual investment, or are you doing this just to further your knowledge? And if you're doing it to further your knowledge, that's great. However, that tends to tip it in the scale more toward being a luxury rather than an investment in your education and your career. If you are willing or able to move before you go to grad school or after you graduate, you're not only likely to be more flexible, so you can get into other programs that you otherwise might not be able to, but you can also be more likely to take advantage of the degree in getting a better job. One thing that many people in the grad school field, especially administrators, can recommend is that people get experience in the field before they go back to grad school, because it does several things. It not only allows them to make some money, but they can find out more about the career and if they'll really like it as their longtime job. And they can make some contacts who can help them hopefully establish themselves after they earn their degree. And finally, and this is from my perspective the biggest question, are you willing to be broke for a long time? You are going to incur probably $100,000 in total costs between lost salary, living expenses, and the expense of going through grad school, even for just a master's program. And paying that back is going to take a long time. So if you are willing to be broke for several years, then yes, you maybe should go back to grad school.
So those are some tough questions, but you're telling me that the more times people say yes to those, the more likely that grad school will indeed be worth it.
Yeah, especially if you are going into a field in which the pay is already good. Generally, what happens if there is already good pay, like it's into, say, computer sciences, going back to grad school really enhances the potential income even more. Whereas if you are looking at a field like, say, journalism that's already a low-pay field, the increase isn't as much for people who have advanced degrees, and it doesn't end up being very much anyway. It comes down to how bad do you want it. If it's a requirement for a desired field that you really want to go into and you're not doing it for the money, great. But don't do it as a default option for your life. And we have a calculator through Kiplinger that can help you add up all the expenses and the potential earnings and the time spent and everything, and decide on a financial basis if grad school is worth it. And we'll have a link to that calculator up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right. It sounds good. By the way, if listeners would like to join in the conversation later on in the hour, 800-642-1234 is our number if you've got a question for Kevin. 800-642-1234. You can also leave an email at onyourmoney@WPR.org. Right now, we get into the disclaimer portion of the program where I say something like, Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors before making any investment decisions. All right, let's go to the mailbag right now. We've got a note here from Renee. And Renee says, my husband and I are in our early 40s. He has a small amount of money in his 401k, and his company matches his deposits into that account. We owe very little on our home and have no other debt. We've got two children who are 7 and 11, and we are hoping to start a college fund of some kind. What should we do on a yearly basis as far as putting college fund and retirement money away?
Renee has a very good and a very common question and issue. The dilemma of should you save for retirement or should you save for college? And for most people, you can borrow money to pay for college expenses, but you can't borrow money to retire. So it's usually better to prioritize retirement savings instead of college savings. We have some answers for Renee that most people would consider as kind of conventional wisdom, but there are some other things that are a bit more unconventional that she and her husband should consider.
All right. Well, let's start with the basic guidance.
Well, her husband should first get her employer's match. Save enough money in the at-work plan so that he can get the match from his employer that goes into the plan. That's guaranteed money. That's one of the best uses for any type of savings they have. Then they want to consider saving money in Roth IRAs. And then most people can save up to $5,000 each. And she can open one as well, even if she doesn't work outside the home. Now, they don't get a tax break on putting money into the Roth IRAs. But as both of the longtime listeners of On Your Money know, you can pull the contributions out of a Roth IRA at any time for any reason whatsoever with no taxes or penalty. So they can use that money for college in the future. Or if they say, you know what, by the time the kids get old enough to go to school, either they're not going to school or they don't need the money or retirement is a bigger priority, Renee and her husband can pull that money out tax-free in retirement. And if they do have more money above and beyond the Roth IRA contributions, then they can go back to the 401k or they can use a 529 college savings plan, which we will be discussing later on in the show.
It sounds like a lot, but what are some of the moves that they might not have thought about?
Well, first of all, and this is something that many people have a hard time dealing with, but it's better to discuss it when it's at your leisure, but estate planning, that if Renee or her husband aren't around and aren't able to care for their kids and pay for their expenses in college, they should have wills, guardians, and they should have life insurance. In a situation like Renee's, both she and her husband should probably have at least $500,000 of life insurance on each one of them. And this is not on the kids, this is on the parents, and it should be term life insurance. And it should be for about 15 years so that by the time their youngest child is generally on their own, the term insurance will last for the duration of that. They should also consider getting a new mortgage. You can tell by Renee's note that she's very proud that they only have a little bit of money left on their mortgage. However, they're getting themselves into a potential bind because they have a lot of their net worth tied up into the equity of their home, and it's very difficult to tap that in an emergency. So they should get a 30-year mortgage. It has a very low interest rate. They should repay it slowly. Any excess money that they can get out of that mortgage, they should put into retirement savings accounts and CDs and college savings accounts. And then they can use that cash for emergencies or for uncovered college expenses. And best of all, they can always repay that mortgage early, Gene, if they want, but they can't get at that home equity when they really need it the most. Now, many people who listen to the show have said, you know, we tried to do this, Kevin, but we just can't bring ourselves to get a new mortgage, and I understand that, and I appreciate it. So if you can't do that, at least get a home equity line of credit against the accumulated equity in your home so that you can draw upon that in an emergency.
All right, so lots and lots to think about there, and we're going to invite listeners to call in with their questions right now. We're talking about education and during this hour, so if you've got an education question, that's great. We'd love to hear from that. And if you've got a question about any kind of other financial issue you'd like to bring up with Kevin, that would be great too. Here's how you get in touch with us. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We've got calls coming up, so stick around here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love.
20 minutes past 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in this week for Joy Cardine. So it looks as though it is time to go to the phones, and we are going to start in Mineral Point. And it looks like Becca is on the line. Hi, Becca.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about graduate certificate programs. I'm feeling a little jumpy about this whole financial thing and taking out a loan right now, but I found a program that matches really well with my interests and what I'm doing with work. It allows me to go to work and go to school. And I have to take out a small loan. I just filled out my FAFSA. And the program is starting this weekend. I still have time to bail, I guess, if it's...
You're getting close, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm very jumpy about a loan because I have a bunch of student loans left over from my college, and they fit into my budget right now, but another one isn't going to, but I'm hoping that in a year it will. So do you have any advice or suggestions?
Well, I think the most important question here, Becca, is one you haven't really asked yet, and so I'll ask it. Which sorority are you pledging? You're not. Okay, good. Let me ask you this. How much, if you don't mind, is the loan you are considering?
It'll be about $5,000.
Oh, $5,000. Okay.
It's small. It's not big. It's not a huge obligation. But just the thought of taking on more debt in this financial climate that we've got going on with higher interest rates and, you know, is it worth it even to take out a small loan?
It probably is. $5,000 is a tiny amount compared to what most people take out when they are borrowing money to go to advance their education and their skills. And especially when you said you can work while you're taking this course, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if you pay back 1% of that loan amount per month of your original loan amount, and this is true with most education loans, you will pay it off in 10 years. That's $50. And, you know, that's what a lot of people to spend at the gas pump at one time. So for a tank of gas per month, you're hopefully advancing your education and advancing your learning skills. Now, in terms of the economy out there, this is a great time to borrow money because interest rates are very low and you're not putting money into the economy, Becca, you're pulling it out. And so I would not worry as much as a borrower as I were if I were a saver or an investor on what the economy comes. So no, for that relatively, if you said $50,000, I would be thinking a little differently on it. But for that relatively low dollar amount, you might see, you know, that much of a bump in wages at some point down the road that would more than cover the loan. So if you have the time, you have the interest, you have the energy, I would definitely encourage you to do it. I understand why you're getting a little cold feet this close to it, but no, go ahead and do it, Finn. It's a relatively small dollar amount for the investment in your future.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Good luck. 3 days to go, and we'll see how Becca turns out. Jeanette is with us now from Sauk City. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi there. I guess I would have to say I'm asking the exact opposite question of most of your callers on this program. I am drawing Social Security. I'm working a full and a part-time job, and I have about $100,000 worth of debt, which I don't foresee I'm ever going to get paid. I guess I have kind of a two-part question. Should I file bankruptcy? And if I don't, what happens to those bills? Because I don't want my children responsible for them. And if that were the case, then maybe I should file bankruptcy. I have worked with all my charge cards. I'm doing hardship payments where there is no interest or any kind of penalties being paid. I'm making my payments, but they're very minimum. I've cut back. I don't go out to eat. I don't drive any more than I have to. I've cut back every place I can. I still have no money to spend. Sometimes I have to choose between buying my groceries and paying a bill. Usually the bill wins out. Do I file bankruptcy or do I keep trying to struggle along? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Jeanette, thanks for the call. Kevin, yeah. Some pretty big issues there.
Well, and Jeanette feels like probably she's on the opposite side of a listenership of a show like On Your Money. And the fact is that's absolutely not true. There are a lot of people who call in with these kinds of questions and many people call in questions about what to do with all my money, or I inherited a bunch of money, or I've retired and I've got more money than I know what to do with, and I'm worried. Those are problems, but those are generally good problems to have. Jeanette has bad problems to have, and so I'm really glad that you called in, Jeanette, and you are not alone. There are over a million people in a typical year who do file for bankruptcy. So typically about 1% of the adult households in America in a given year file for bankruptcy, and many times it's much more than that. I wouldn't worry as much about your children taking on your debt only against any assets that you might be leaving to them otherwise. But bankruptcy, and we're going to be covering this later on in the year, but bankruptcy is not a good thing. It shouldn't be the first option, but it sure doesn't sound like it's Jeanette's first option. It sounds like she's done everything she possibly can. And one of the reasons that bankruptcy laws are in place is nobody wants debtor's prisons, and nobody wants people to be so afraid of borrowing money or taking chances in the economy that they're worried that they'll be subject to a lifetime of servitude trying to repay loans that for whatever reason were taken out. Banks know this, lenders, credit cards, all these companies are very well aware that they're not going to get paid back on every single penny. So while it's not a good situation, it certainly isn't something that's the end of the world. It might even feel like that in Jeanette's case. Jeanette, we're going to put a link up at the onyourmoney.com website to a great page on the Wisconsin Law Library. It's wilawlibrary.gov, but they have a fantastic page that completely deals with bankruptcy and about all the legal guide for it. I would definitely recommend that you go through that and then also contact an attorney to help you walk through it to find out what your options are and what your obligations are. It's not as easy as just say, you know what, I went on a spending bender for a few weeks. I've got $100,000 in debt. You know what, I think I'll just write no thank you on the credit card statement and I'm scot-free. It's painful, but it's still there for a reason, and it's a legal right for Jeanette in many cases to go through it and other people like her. So I would definitely recommend you do it. And again, we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right, let's move on. David is with us now from Marshfield. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I work for an LLC, and part of my compensation package includes non-voting shares of the company. And those come from a pool that represent 3% ownership in the company. And the CEO has no intention of ever selling the company. It's just one of those things where he'll probably run it until the day he dies. And I was wondering if it would be worth selling those shares. I could sell them to other employees who own shares or anybody. and using that money and putting it into my 401k or investing it in some other fashion?
Based solely on the scant information you can provide over the air, David, I would say yes, it is, and here's why. Your well-being is already tied to the well-being of your employer. And many times people who have some type of ownership in their employer or their own company, when things are going great, they're going really well. And when things are going bad, they're going terrible, meaning not only are you earning less money, but you have less job security, plus money that you have set aside is not doing as well either because the company isn't worth as much. And that's true, you know, if you work for the local gas and sip or General Motors. If everything's going well at your employer and you own the stock in the employer, it's going great, and it can be exacerbated on the other side of it. So offhand, simply as a diversification tool, I would recommend that if you can get a decent price for the shares and you can sell it and you can put it into a 401k, if I'm wrong and you're wrong and the company does really well going forward, you're still going to have great job security and lots of work opportunity and hopefully an increase in income. But if things don't work out that way, you'll be very glad that you have some money that has nothing to do really with your employer.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, David. Let's move on. Take one more call. Deborah is with us from Economowoc. Hi, Deborah.
Yeah, hi. I have a complex situation, and I'm not sure what I need to do about it. My husband has been in charge of our finances with all of our married life, and I contributed at different times by working, but mainly I have been disabled, and this was a lot of money that I contributed personally. It was about $142,000 at the beginning of our marriage, which I bought a car and a house with, and the rest was used by the family to help fix up the house. And then in the late 80s, I got about $125,000 in inheritance, and I bought us a house and took a small trip to Europe.
Excuse me, Deb. Deb, yes. What was your question?
Okay, my question is, at this point in time, my husband got sick with Parkinson's, and he has been financially irresponsible all our life. I was not even allowed to handle my money by Social Security Administration until 2 years ago. Presently, I am working on getting disabled.
Okay, Deb, I'm sorry. Deb, excuse me. We're running short on time here. Do you have a question? I understand you're in a really tight situation right now, and I'd like to try to help you, but you do need to actually ask, what's your question?
Okay. I'm being denied student loans unless, or access to student loans, meaning they said that unless I could prove to them in specific wording through my doctor that they would not allow me to have access to student loans. And my doctor wrote them a very positive letter, but I was not given any student loans. I was given some grants, which is fine. But I need to go to graduate school to, it's not Facilius, it's that as a social worker, I will not be able to get a decent job without a master's. And I will be graduating in December. And we are going through a legal separation right now, and I am wondering if the lawyer or if there's any way I can protect myself in the future with regards to loans in terms of having a statement drawn up about why we lost our house, because I did not make the decision to go bankrupt.
It actually sounds like a very tough situation. Your lawyer is the person whom I would contact to say, I need to do this. That's more of a legal question. And I wish I could help you out. It sounds like you've really been through a lot. But definitely talk with the lawyer about it and see if the lawyer can answer that question and get that type of obligation. It's very common when couples are separating that if there is one who feels that he or she is not responsible for some of these debts, if their name is on the account, they are usually. But otherwise, they don't want any future obligations. So good luck to you, Deborah. Thank you very much for your call.
And more generally, Kevin, any way to with these student loans, when we run into, you know, obstacles like this, what should people be thinking about? Because the situation that Deborah brought up sounds almost mind-boggling. And so how do you prioritize these things and kind of see your way to the end?
Well, one of the problems with student loans that people should know is before they take it out, I do generally encourage borrowing money to go to school before you tap savings. However, with many student loans, it's very difficult to discharge those through bankruptcy or any other means. So if you do borrow money for it, you are going to be on the hook for those loans and the repayments. And part of the reason that it is difficult to discharge is because there's generally no tangible asset underneath that. Education is generally great. It usually leads to a higher income somewhere down the road, but it's difficult for, it's not a house, it's not a building, it's not a car. So it's difficult for the lender to go back and say, well, you know, we're going to seize upon, they've already said we're going to seize upon your higher income to help repay the loan. And if they couldn't do that, most people would just walk away from it.
And that's a very nice segue into the smart assets portion of our program. Before we go to that, though, very quickly, our phone number, 800-642-1234. And in smart assets this time around, we're going to be talking about education, how you can save for it. And, Kevin, the primary tool that families use to specifically save for future high education expenses is called the 529 plan. I think a lot of people have heard of that. And Wisconsin's is pretty good version, but it may have gotten a little bit better.
Yeah, college savings plans, Gene, are generally accounts where people get to deposit money and any future earnings or growth in the account is sheltered from taxation. And then if it's withdrawn for qualified higher education expenses, and generally the definition is fairly liberal, it's tax-free. Almost all states sponsor some kind of plan, but then they usually turn the actual management of the money over to one or more mutual fund companies like Vanguard. Wisconsin uses Wells Fargo for many of this. And Wisconsin's Edvest plan has about $1 billion in the accounts and currently serves about 68,000 students. It's fairly highly regarded and it's getting better. SavingForCollege.com, which is the leading authority on evaluation of college savings plans, recently gave the plan top marks for their past investment performance, and they've made that even better with some recent improvements.
And so what were some of those improvements?
Well, there's a more liberal tax break for deposits. Again, you generally don't get, it's not like a 401k or an IRA where you get an automatic tax reduction on the money that you put in. However, there is an incentive that Wisconsin residents who put qualifying money into an account of up to $3,000 per beneficiary per year can remove up to $3,000 from their taxable income at the state level for Wisconsin. And that can mean generally if you put $3,000 in the plan in a year, it saves you about maybe $100 to $150 in state taxes. Now they've said that individuals do not have to open up a new plan. So let's say if an uncle who lives in Wisconsin wants to put money into the Edvest plan for his niece, but the niece's parents have actually opened the account, the uncle can still put the money into the account and qualify for the tax deduction. Also, the administrators of the Edvest plan have added new funds. They took out some more high expense funds and put in some Vanguard ones that have lower internal expenses. And that's very important because in these times when returns are likely to be lower going forward, expenses can eat up a greater share of total returns. So focusing on lowering the expense ratio of these funds can be very important to helping families accumulate more money down the road.
And so who are the people who should be most interested in saving when you're looking at a college savings plan like this?
Well, anyone who has, you know, a child in mind or even for themselves, you can use this for yourselves to save for future grad school expenses or to go back to school, what have you. But generally, it's more money and more maturity. People who, first of all, are in a higher income bracket, have already saved or are saving enough for retirement, and expect to be paying high taxes on their savings and would like to shelter that if possible. Second of all, it's grandparents. And this is really nice about the Edvest and other college savings plans is grandparents keep ownership of the account. So if you've just had a new grandchild and that little baby's 6 months old, you don't know what he or she is going to turn out to be like, and you don't know if he or she is going to even need the money for college. So you can put the money into an Edvest plan for her benefit, and you still keep control over it. And if for whatever reason you need the money, you can pull it out, you pay some small taxes and penalties, or you can transfer it to another grandchild or a member of the family, and even you can wait for the next generation. There's generally no sunset on these plans saying, hey, this kid is 30, she's obviously not going to college, you should pull the money out now and pay taxes on it. There's no deadline to most of these plans.
And finally, what kind of advice would you give to those people who are considering a college savings plan?
Well, first of all, they should save a little and save often. A few hundred dollars a month can be deducted automatically from your checking account, and you tend to not notice it. And then you can avoid having to, you know, think about writing a check and making the transfer for it. Also, try to use age-based portfolios. These are portfolios that start out more aggressive when the child is very young, and as she gets closer to college age and using the money, the portfolio becomes more conservative. It shifts more of the money out of equity funds and into bond and cash management accounts. And finally, when people have saved money in these, as we mentioned, there's $1 billion in there, and 60-some thousand kids have Edvest accounts set up for them, try to use loans first to pay for college and savings last, because we never know what kind of loans will be available down the road. So it's better to take the loans while you can get them now and use the savings last. Most people do it the other way around, and it's usually more prudent to get the loans first and use savings last.
You know, and all this sounds very complicated, but it just sounds like you're saying we've got to be very deliberate about planning for this and really have to think about it.
Think about it, and then the nice thing about doing both the age-based plan and the automatic deposits is once you do get over the hurdle of making the decision and the commitment, a lot of the work is done. It's not something you have to watch on a day-to-day basis.
All right, very good. Pay for college. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you've got a question for Kevin, whether it's regarding education or any other sort of financial issue you've got. 800-642-1234. Let's go to Madison right now. And Dan joins us. Hi, Dan.
Oh, yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is not relating to a 529 plan, although I do envision opening one of those for a child in the future. But my question today concerns opening up a mutual fund, preferably in a Roth IRA, with the specific intent to use this money in the future for a down payment on a home. And I was wondering, in order to let this money grow safely, what proportion of stocks versus bonds should I envision investing in this mutual fund or funds?
It's a noble attempt, and I do endorse it. The question, though, or the issue that I might have, Dan, is if there's a safe thing, such a thing as a safe stock or a safe bond. And there really isn't. The only safe investment out there really are certificates of deposit. And for better or for worse, those aren't going to give you much in the rate in the way of return. Generally, 2 to 3% is the most you're going to get for it. Now, you can put a CD within a Roth IRA, but it won't grow very fast. If you're comfortable with a little risk and a little volatility, you might get better growth for it. How long might you be leaving the money in there, Dan, before you purchase a home?
Oh, sure. The timeline I envision is about 4 to 5 years.
Okay. You might be okay with a more conservative mix. Vanguard, which I really like, has a fund that has a shorter time period for that and generally has about a third mix of stocks, bonds, and cash. But even then, you can expect some volatility for better or worse. It might be volatile to the upside. You might get some growth. Or it might be volatile to the downside. So I wouldn't count on the money necessarily being there in its current form. It's not going to go to zero. But also, if you are adding to it, hopefully you can take advantage of dollar cost averaging and buy more shares when the value is low and it will be there. Now, when you do use a Roth IRA for a home down payment, you can pull the contribution back out at any time, as I mentioned, and that's tax and penalty free. And then there are ways to qualify for your first home purchase that allow you to avoid not taxes on any earnings, but penalties on it. So let's say the account grows from $10,000 contributed to $11,000. You can pull the $11,000 out, and you will pay taxes on the $1,000 growth, but probably not a penalty on it. So I don't think the Roth IRA is the best way to save for it, but it is a nice way to put some money aside that you might want to use for the home.
Sure, sure. So for that 4 to 5 year timeline, roughly one third balance is pretty reasonable.
Yeah, that's reasonable. And again, still don't be shocked if you take a 5 to 10% haircut at least at some point down the road. So don't look for growth first out of this. It's just in this environment right now, it's very difficult to find safe, high rates of return. You can either have safety or you can have potentially high rates of return, but it's very difficult to find both.
Dan, thanks for the call, and good luck with all that. Sounds like you've got some pretty good plans in mind. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you've got a question for Kevin. We're going to take a break right now. We'll come back to the phones and take those questions. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop.
Better shop around. It's that time of the program, and we're talking about education today. And there are several ways, of course, to spend less and get more in terms of higher education. But, Kevin, do families shop around as much as they should?
Not in terms of cost versus benefit. And it's very ironic because there are very few things that people spend more money on than higher education for themselves or for their children. But there is probably nothing else out there that has a less correlation between spending a lot of money and getting a really good education. This involves looking at costs both out of pocket, your total expenses after any financial aid is awarded. And more importantly, living in a state like Wisconsin just blows me away. How many kids, I understand they're 18, they want to get out of state, but go to public schools out of state that are no better than many schools they could get right here in America's Dairyland, but they end up spending $10,000 or more per year because they're paying out-of-state tuition. This goes more so if you're paying for a small or a private school. And even people say, well, you know what, it's real expensive, but if my kid goes to an Ivy League school, he or she is going to benefit so much more for that that it's worth the cost, and especially if we're paying for it out of pocket. And the truth is that is very doubtful. Princeton, which is an Ivy League school, did a study on trying to see the benefit of going to one of their schools, the Harvards and the Dartmouths, within that category, and found that the correlation between the actual school and future earnings was actually almost non-existent. What they found that there was a correlation between SAT scores, but that was true whether the kid went to an Ivy League school or not. The only way they found any type of advantage to going to a very high-priced Ivy League school was if the kid made some connections there that he or she otherwise wouldn't have.
So what kind of cost-effective institutions are you talking about?
Kiplinger's, which is one of my favorite magazines and websites, publishes the best values of all the top 100 options for universities and colleges in the country. Their criteria is generally not just cost, but also test scores, faculty ratio, the amount of debt people have to take on before they can graduate. And Wisconsin schools scored very well. Madison, Eau Claire, and La Crosse, all the universities there scored in the top 100. And then in private schools, Marquette and Beloit did very well. And then even for neighboring states, the University of Minnesota scored very well, as did the University of Illinois and the branch in Illinois at Normal.
So what's another lesser-known way that you can save money in college costs?
A lot of people just look at tuition. And tuition for most schools is usually just half of the total cost of going to school. The other half is the cost of living, rent, room and board, all the other expenses. And if you send your kid someplace that's several thousand miles away and the kid plans on coming back and making two or three trips a year, that can easily be $2,000 or $3,000 on top of it if they have to fly and take a day's worth of travel to get through. Also, people who are looking at going to school in an urban area. Generally, rents are going to be much higher there. And if you try to save money on rent, you may end up putting your naive little 18-year-old in a kind of a dodgy area that you otherwise wouldn't want him or her walking through, much less living on a day-to-day basis. And then finally, the logistics of getting around. If there's no public transportation, if the kid wants to get a job or go shopping and try to find goods and services that are less expensive than they are near campus, it's better to have a car, of course, but then there's a cost of not only having the car, but parking it and worrying about it getting broken into and insurance and all that.
And finally, the last bit of advice for families who are shopping for a college.
Four words: get in and get out. Right now, about 25% of students who are going to enroll in colleges in this fall will actually have a degree by the time 4 years are up. Some will never get a degree. Some will take 5 or 6 years to do so. Now, sometimes that can't be avoided because programs are difficult to get into. But generally, one more year of college adds 20 to 30% to the cost of going to college. So not only do you lose out on opportunities to get a job while you're graduating, the sooner you graduate, the sooner you can enter the job market or the grad school application process. But it also adds up a ton of money and frustration for the family. So first of all, take AP classes while you're in high school. Consider going to a bigger school that has more majors. Many kids change their major while they're going through school. And if they're at a smaller school that doesn't offer a wide array of programs, they may have to transfer. And usually when you transfer from one school to another, you take a couple steps back before you start moving forward in the process. Kids should avoid working at all costs. I'd much rather have students take an extra 3 credits during the semester than a job at 10 to 15 hours a week, because then they can get out of school faster and go through summers and winter programs as well. Those are usually some of the ways that you can pile up a lot of credits in a hurry and add to that, and then you can hopefully get out in 4 years rather than 5 or 6.
All right. Get in, get out. All right, I'm writing that down. 800-642-1234. We're going to go ahead back to the phones right now, get some more questions for Kevin if you'd like to join in. That is our toll-free number. Let's start with Jennifer, who is with us from La Crosse. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning. I apologize. This is not concerning education. But
it's okay.
I was wondering, I unfortunately have a brother that was just sent to prison, and he asked me to be his power of attorney for finances. I'm wondering what that all entails.
Hmm. Well, this will be an education for a lot of people, and I'm sorry about your brother's unfortunate circumstances, but I'm glad he has you there for him to help him while he's unavailable to manage things. Basically, it gives you the legal right, and it has to be a legal right. It can't be just, you know, he signs a note saying it's okay for my sister to tap into this. And we will be talking about this in a few weeks. Where this comes up to more a common situation, Jennifer, is when people have a power of attorney over their parents' affairs. If their parents are getting older and they don't feel that they can manage their affairs as well as they otherwise might, generally they'll give a power of attorney to a trusted child. So your brother obviously trusts you. It is a legal document. You do have a responsibility to only work in his interest. And what I would do is, if you do establish this, document everything that you do for his benefit. Like if you write a check to a company to pay a credit card bill, let's say, just document in there that you wrote the check on this day, why you would be spending any money for it. So if there is any issue down the road when he gets out and says, well, why did you do this? You'll have some, not only some memory from it, but some evidence of the decision that you made and why you do it. But it basically gives you the right to not only manage his assets or affairs, but also the responsibility to do it in his best interest. So again, we'll put a really good link up to some information on that from the Wisconsin Law Library at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Jennifer, thanks so much for the call. Let's head to Appleton right now, and Sue joins us. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I have a son who will be going into college next year, so he'll be a senior in high school this year. And we're looking into getting him a young adult Visa card from our local credit union to start building his credit. Is that a good idea?
I think it's a great idea. For several reasons, one of which is he is being exposed to the world of credit, hopefully while you are monitoring it. Are you going to be on the account, Sue, or are you going to have access to the information?
I'll be a co-applicant.
Co-applicant, okay. I wouldn't do it unless you are comfortable paying off the credit card for him. So you probably want as low of spending limit as possible. But it does help him establish a credit report, which is very important, because not only will he be borrowing money at some point down the road, either for school or for a car or maybe a new home, but also many employers judge some of their employees' credit records as part of the hiring process. And sometimes it's because they feel it's part of the screening process. Other ones are required to do it by their insurers. And so the employer might look at that, and if he demonstrates a responsibility with credit, it might make him more attractive than a person who's either never had credit, never demonstrated the ability to use it responsibly, or has had credit and mismanaged it. So yes, I definitely think it's a good idea, as long as you are comfortable being responsible for whatever charges he makes, and he understands and you understand that you are on the account. You know everything that he's going to spend it on. It's amazing how, you know, an 18-year-old going off to college and says, right, only for emergencies, that, you know, four large pizzas at 3 o'clock in the morning turn into an emergency. And I may or may not have been guilty of that myself several years ago.
Is there any problem with getting it through the credit union where we have our accounts and, you know, with all the internet stuff that can go on of hacking into accounts and things like that?
I wouldn't say that there's any more problem with a typical local institution than there would be otherwise. You can check the credit union's policies for protection. You know, if there's only $500 of credit limit on there, at the worst case scenario you'd ever be responsible for is $500 of charges. But even then, with credit cards, users generally have way more protection with the credit cards against use than they do with save and debit cards. So no, I wouldn't be as worried about some, you know, Russian at a computer hacking into it as I would about you know, just your son's use.
Okay. Sue, thanks for the call. And let's head back to the Fox Valley right now in Oshkosh, and Jay is with us. Good morning.
Morning. You know, going back to Kevin's comment earlier, he said that he recommended using loans ahead of drawing on the 529 plan. My daughter's going to the school this fall, the freshman. We have some money saved in 529 plans. She was eligible for the unsubsidized loan. My thought was reversed, that I would first, you know, tap out her 529 accounts, and then we'd start doing loans, so that way she isn't accumulating interest that, you know, she'd wait until it starts the interest, obviously, if we start to use the loans later in her college life. And then my second question, kind of related, would be, we'd prefer for any additional loans that we might need, would they be in her name? Are there any recommended sources for those types of loans beyond the federal subsidized or unsubsidized loans?
In most prudent people choose to use savings first rather than using loans. And in this environment, in this world, it's actually more prudent to use the loans first while you can, and then use savings as the last resort, because then the savings will always be there, not only to be used for college, but also for other family emergencies that come up. You know, if something happens to you and you say, you know, we actually need to eat this month versus worrying about tuition costs, the savings will be there, but you can't get a student loan so that you can, you know, survive from month to month. So, and we don't even know in, you know, 3 or 4 years what loans will be available, if any. I'm sure 3 or 4 years ago, people always thought that subsidized grad school loans would always be there. Well, they're probably not going to be there in the very near future. So, yeah, definitely use loans first. Keep the savings sacred later on. And then in terms of what types of loans, I would go to your local institution first, see what type of education loans that they offer, and then also check in with the school's financial aid department and see if they have any recommendations as well.
All right, Jay, thanks so much for the call, and good luck with your daughter's education. Well, Kevin, we've got a minute or so for the website of the week.
It's a special 4-pack of education-related websites, and you don't have to... Jay and all the other drivers out there listening, you don't have to scramble for a pen, because we'll have these up at onyourmoney.com later on today. Savingforcollege.com is the best place for college savings plan information. FinAid.org is the best place to get general financial aid information. The FAFSA one that one of our previous callers mentioned is FAFSA.ed.gov. That's the first step into getting federal financial aid for families. And then finally, when you have student loans and you have a difficult time repaying it, there is a plan in place that can allow you to reduce the amount that you have to pay on a monthly basis. And that's at IBRinfo.org, IBRinfo.org. And again, we'll have all those websites up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And without further ado, 4 more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
There you are. And stay warm, by the way.
Thank you.
See you later. Kevin McKinley on Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. He joins us every week, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Rob Ferret produced this hour. We had on-air production from Chris Molina. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here this week. I'm filling in all week long for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.